Friday, 5 p.m. Don't I sound so happy?
Yeah, you sound so thrilled about it.
I'm glad to be here. The end of another grueling week. I hope everybody's got some good plans for the weekend.
It ain't over yet. You've got plans for this weekend.
That's right. You know, a lot of stuff going on. You know, I should mention it right now since you've brought it up. This weekend, there's a benefit happening at KJ Farrell's in Belmore. This is a benefit for Rock Ken Roll. This is a really cool organization that pretty much marries charity with music by putting on special events where all of the money is given to families in need. And I don't need to tell you that we are at a point in time in our history, especially here on Long Island, unfortunately, where the food banks are desperately in need of support. So a benefit is taking place tomorrow at KJ Farrell's, as I said, in Belmore, tomorrow afternoon. It's running from 1 o'clock until 6 o'clock. It's being put on by Bill Herman and his recording studio, Paradiddle Records, in conjunction with our organization, NIRMA, the New York Roots Music Association. We're going to be featuring a whole series of various bands, including NIRMA performers, dedicating the entire day to the music of the Beatles. There'll be one act that's going to be performing songs exclusively by George Harrison, another doing songs exclusively by John, the same thing for Paul McCartney. NIRMA will come on at the toward the end of the evening, and we're going to be performing two Beatles albums in their entirety. And for, I think it's a $20 admission. I think it's 20 or 25. Might be 25 day of the show. But understand, the money is 100% for a good cause, to help Rock Ken Roll. If you can come, if you can bring a can or some durable goods, no ice cream, please. But if you could come on down and basically support the cause, we'd really all appreciate it so much. And there's about a good 50 musicians giving their time and their talents and rehearsals and everything else that went into this. Nobody's going to make a penny. I'm just going to do all of this just to pretty much help support our fellow Long Islanders who may be in need, especially as the weather is turning cold and the food banks are pretty low. So you can come down, have a good time, and feel even better about it than you might otherwise, because it's definitely for a good cause, and we plan to have a really good time doing it. That's at KJ Farrell's in Belmore tomorrow between 1 o'clock and 6 p.m. in the afternoon. Hope I can see you there. All right, that being said, let's get back to our Clapton series and how music changed, part 10. We pick up in a very different place than where we left off, although this is completely chronological. Clapton pretty much vanished, went into self-induced exile for 3 years, pretty much leaving after the whole Derek and the Dominoes thing, and by nurturing a heroin addiction. He deliberately removed himself from music and pretty much was doing nothing. As he puts it, I'll read directly from the autobiography of Eric Clapton. "The cost of our lifestyle was not just high in human terms. It was beginning to cripple me financially. Each week I was spending about £1,000 on heroin."
That's like double U.S. dollars.
Right, that's equivalent to about £8,000 today, or $15,000 a week. "For a period of time, I managed to hide from Stigwood the true amount, but eventually he cottoned on to what was going on. And I received a message from the office saying that funds were running low and I would soon have to start selling things to pay for my habit."
Interesting.
"If that gave me something to think about, then so did a letter that I received from my girlfriend's father, David, in which he told me in no uncertain terms that he would be quite happy to turn us both into the police if I wasn't prepared to stop what I was doing to myself and, more important, to his daughter. His letter was quite ruthless, but compassionate at the same time. 'I love you both so much,' he wrote, 'that I cannot bear to see what you are doing to yourselves. For all that you can do and all you can have in your lives, please let me help you.' He finished off by saying, 'I will probably never know how much courage it will take, dear Eric, but for your own sake, please do it.' It was clear that he meant business, and I knew deep down that I was inflicting serious damage on an unsuspecting innocent, somebody I had no right to meddle with. I realized that I had to put the brakes on, if not for my sake, then for hers." So let's play a track, which is eventually, as Eric Clapton does come out, he starts to, we'll tell the story a little bit later on, but he ends up being sent to Florida to work on an album. Here's an outtake from the sessions for that album, a version of Eric Clapton performing a version of a Jimmy Reed song called Ain't That Lovin' You. Thank you. so unusual, that recording, because he sounds completely asleep at the wheel until you get to that guitar solo, when all of a sudden he just jumps to life and
pulls it out.
He sounds, his playing is incredibly energetic and awesome, but you can't help but wonder if it's the heroin that was causing him to sing in such a laconic way. I'm sure Clapton himself would say that that was the J.J. Cale influence coming out. So it's hard to really say which is which. By the way, that's Dave Mason playing second guitar on that track. Ain't that Lovin' You Baby. Well, let's continue reading then. See, Clapton, from his biography about what he was trying to do to help himself get out of the situation that he was in with drugs. Basically, his father-in-law then told me that he had come across an extraordinary woman, Dr. Meg Patterson, a Scottish neurosurgeon who had worked for years in Hong Kong, where she had developed a method of treating opiate withdrawal symptoms using a form of electrical acupuncture that she called neuroelectric therapy. Their cure was a form of acupuncture using an electrical stimulator made in China, which Meg had bought in Hong Kong. This took the form of a small black box with wires radiating out of it attached to small clips holding tiny needles that were applied to various points within the contour of the ear. The treatment involved 3 hour-long sessions a day and would necessitate the Pattersons coming to live with us at Hurtwood for at least the first week. Cautiously, we agreed. Well, the first thing explained to us was that we were not allowed to touch any heroin from day one. This really did come as a shock, as I had somehow thought that we would be weaned slowly off of it. She set up her apparatus in the room we used as a den next to our sitting room. The clips were put on my ears like clip-on earrings. The needles were inserted in various pressure points in my earlobes, and when the machine was switched on, it would pass a very mild electric current through the needles. A knob turned the current up to the point where it started to get tingly and turned it down until you could only just feel it. I did make a kind of recovery, and they did help a great deal, in fact, by encouraging me to listen and play music again. By doing this, I got back in touch with my feelings, and they came back in a flood. Looking back, I honestly believe that they did their best that they could with what they had, but it wasn't enough, because for all the good they may have done in getting me off heroin, to then let me loose without any real aftercare was uninformed and dangerous. They seem to have had no knowledge or of any interest in any of the 12-step programs like AA or NA, which have been active and flourishing in London and throughout England since the mid-40s.
Right.
After my treatments, their idea of rehabilitation, planned with the help of David, the father of his girlfriend, was to send me to live on a farm outside Oswestry, run by David's youngest son, Frank Ormsby Gore. The plan was that I should get physically well and sort myself out. The reality was, the minute I got up to the farm, I simply traded one abusable substance for another. We'll continue the story by playing another track, which was an outtake from the same sessions of 1974 for his next album. This actually was the track that led off Clapton's second box set called Eric Clapton Crossroads 2, Live in the 70s. Oddly, I believe it was a studio track coming out of Cristeria Studios, though, that led off that collection. Here's Clapton performing Walking Down the Road. Thank you.
declare she's dead and gone. Things look so black, you got to travel all alone. Things look so black, you got to travel all alone. In this world, no, I declare she's gone. It ain't too good, you ain't got a shelter over your head. It don't look so good. Got a shelter over your head. When you could have been sleeping, no, in a feather bed, yeah. Down that lonesome road, have you ever been walking down that lonesome road? And all you got in this world.
Some of the sleepy blues that Clapton started to be working on when he was finally trying to get himself back up and out to work. Well, here he is now talking about the second phase of his recovery, working on the farm. I'll continue reading here as we get into the music. So basically, I'm playing the songs because, like I said, it was a three-year period, and I just didn't want to have like nothing but silence or just an entire show of talking about it. Well, Clapton's words again. Since I was so unfit after 3 years of doing little more than lying in a nod on a couch in front of the TV, the agreement was that, to begin with, I would work according to my condition. There was a lot of work to be done. Frank was running a farm that barely broke even and doing it virtually single-handed. I was soon up at dawn working like a maniac, baling hay, chopping logs, sawing trees, and mucking out the cows. It was the kind of manual labor I hadn't done since working with my grandfather on a building site, and I really loved it. At around 5 or 6, he would pick me up, and then we'd go into Oswestry and hit the pubs, where we'd listen to the jukebox and drink until we could hardly stand up. Sometimes we'd make complete asses of ourselves, but we were doing it in public, in an outward manner, and after the reclusive way I'd been living, that seemed very healthy. Then we'd go back to the cottage, and Frank would fix some dinner, and we'd drink some more. I was having the best time I'd had for a long time, although you can see how the alcohol now is beginning to take the place Yeah.
Like, okay.
Exactly.
They weren't too savvy on this recovery business.
Throughout the course of my addiction, Robert Stigwood had always believed that I would come through. Even though it was an enormous gamble for him, he stuck by me, and one of the first things I did on my return was to arrange a meeting with him. "What do you want to do?" he asked, "because I know what I want you to do." I said, "Well, I've got these ideas, and I think I want to make a record." "Well, that's great," he said, "because that's exactly what I had in mind. Here are your tickets to Miami, and the studio's already booked."
Isn't that where he used to get all his drugs in the first place?
Eventually, yeah, down in Miami. Right. The studio's already booked. Tom Dowd to produce it and engineer it if you want him. And that was it. It had all been prearranged, and they were just waiting for me. I remember thinking how great his foresight was in putting together a deal I could just step into. He'd also rented us a house, 461 Ocean Boulevard, a luxury home right on the seafront in Miami Beach, and I flew there at once. Having come from the Dominoes, who were hard-playing musicians, very full-on and loud and strong, it was a very different experience to jam with such a laid-back attitude, and I enjoyed it for hours on end. But listening to these guys, I realized that I was miles behind and needed to catch up, and fast. After hibernating for years and being completely out of touch, I wanted to know what everyone was listening to and what was going on in the world of music. I knew I could still play from the heart, and no matter how primitive or sloppy it sounded, it would be real, and that was my strength. Also, I was tired of the guitar hero thing. I wanted to just blend into the band and play more rhythm. I was starting to follow the example of J.J. Cale, whom Delaney had turned me onto in the late 60s, and these guys actually knew him. Carl had even played on some of his records. It all seemed to fit that my return should be with minimalist players, since that's exactly where I wanted to go. Apart from one song which I had finished on my own, most of the material for this album was cover versions of songs like Willie and the Hand Jive, Steady Rollin' Man, and I Can't Hold Out, and this track, which is also a cover version, but reworked drastically for the album 461 Ocean Boulevard. From that album, here's Motherless Children. a significant increase in energy in the output there compared to the first two songs, of course, right?
Yes.
Of course, you could probably very likely due to the fact that the band was trying to push Clapton as he was trying to lay back. They were trying to basically say, maybe we ought to push it up a notch. I think George Terry might have been very influential in that regard. He was the other guitar player, and he's on that track, and it just seems that his presence somehow managed to energize things, because he was like the idea man at this point in time. Clapton was really trying to pull things down and simplify it, and it looked like George Terry was trying to come up with ideas to basically give the album some body and some heft.
Some legs.
Right, so he deserves a lot of credit. Now, we mentioned that Clapton said, in that last quote, he said that he had written he came into the sessions with just one song. Well, here he is talking about that. When I'm trying to write songs, I like to leave things as unfinished as I can so that whoever I'm going to play the song with has a chance to influence, by the way they play it, the way the song will end up. What I was doing in my mind in this case was preparing small groups of ideas that I could take to Carl, Jamie, and Dick and say, let's work on this. Then hopefully, when we actually came to play it, the song would almost finish itself.
Cool.
Yeah. One of the songs I had started was coming along quite well, and I was very proud of my inventiveness in the verse. This was Let It Grow. And it was several years before I realized that I had totally ripped off Stairway to Heaven, the famous Zeppelin anthem, a cruel justice, seeing as how I'd always been such a severe critic of theirs. See if you could hear the difference. Here's Clapton's track entitled Let It Grow.
Standing at the crossroads, trying to read the signs, to tell me which way I should go to find the answer. And all the time I know, plant your love and let it grow. Let it grow, let it grow, let it blossom. Check out of my mind. It's hard to get a friend that I can count on. There's nothing left to show. Plant your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow. Let it blossom. Rest is up to you. Plant your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow. Let it blossom, let it flow. In the sun, the rain, the snow.
Let it grow, let it grow.
Clapton admitted it is quite obvious, isn't it?
Yes.
That it really does lift a great deal from...
Pay Led Zeppelin for that?
For Stairway to Heaven, yeah. I guess they never... They probably spoke about it, but I've never heard of anything about any lawsuit or anything.
Right.
Now, that's got George Terry, of course, not on guitar, but also on vocals. The other person who was singing all over this album is Yvonne Elliman. She was the one who played Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar when that album had come out a couple of years before this.
Yeah.
And she was brought into these sessions. And, of course, although Eric Clapton is still pursuing Patty, now that Yvonne Elliman is on these sessions, he's having pretty much a torrid affair with her during the recording of this entire album.
As you do.
It's taking place.
Love the one you're with.
He'd even like the song Get Ready was written for what was happening and the way that he felt about Yvonne. But another track, Mainline Florida, was written by George Terry, a local musician who had mysteriously joined our happy throng. He was a friend of Albie Gallutin, another local player that I had hung out with and met during the recording of Layla and the sessions with Derek and the Dominoes. So, as I pointed George Terry as being probably a very important character in Clapton's story at this point in time, at least for energizing him, let's hear the song that was written by George Terry from the album 461 Ocean Boulevard. This is Mainline Florida.
Thank you.
Florida, from 461 Ocean Boulevard. We now reach a point in the story that I was probably dreading from the second I decided that I was going to be covering Eric Clapton and doing this series. Because you start thinking about saying, oh, there's certain things that I just let commercial radio do it. I don't want to do it. But I'll tell the story and off we go. Again, George Terry. One day, George Terry came in with an album called Burnin' by Bob Marley and the Wailers, a band I'd never heard of. When he played it, I was mesmerized. He especially liked the track I Shot the Sheriff and kept saying to me, you would have cut this. You would have cut this. We could make it sound great. But it was hardcore reggae, and I wasn't sure we could do it justice. We did a version anyway, and although I didn't say so at the time, I wasn't that enamored with it. Ska, bluebeat, and reggae were familiar mediums to me. I had grown up hearing them in the clubs and on the radio because of England's growing communities of West Indians. But it was quite new to the Americans, and they weren't as finicky as I was about the way it should be played. Not that I knew myself how to play it. I just knew we weren't doing it right.
Fair enough.
When we got to the end of the sessions and started to collate the songs we had, I told them I didn't think Sheriff should be included, as it didn't do the Wailers' version justice. But everyone said, no, no, honestly, this is a hit. And sure enough, when the album was released and the record company chose it as a single, to my utter astonishment, it went straight to number one. Eric Clapton, number one hit in the summer of 1974. In the interest of mixing it up at least a little bit, rather than playing the hit version that is played ad nauseum, even to this day on classic radio, here's a live version of the same track.
Bye.
The comeback hit, the live version of it, at least. That's the version that actually appears on the Crossroads album that was released, Clapton's collection that came out. And I guess at this point you could say mid-career, since it's now about maybe 25 years old since that box set has been released.
Wow.
Well, we'll let, Eric Clapton have the last word. He's going to jam out here to jam out to the end of the show. I'll give him the last word here. With the huge success of I Shot the Sheriff and the subsequent release of the album 461 Ocean Boulevard in July 1974, it was time to go out on the road again. And Stigwood had planned a massive six-week, 28-city tour of North American stadiums, a decision that my newly appointed manager, Roger Forrester, apparently profoundly disagreed with. He felt that I should be brought back slowly and gently with a shorter tour playing in smaller venues. But for whatever reason, the Stigwood plan held, and we were off again, big time. Well, here's a jam of Clapton performing Willie and the Hand Jive and Get Ready from that tour. And when we return next week, we'll come back with Clapton's album recordings from 1975 and some more of his subsequent tour from that year as well, as he becomes something of a touring machine. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next Friday. Have a great weekend.
is a man.